Blog Talk Radio.
This is ATL Designer, the host of In the Mood, and you are listening to Unmasked with authoress Terry E. Lyle, right here on Blog Talk Radio. You know, Terry brings you all the hot topics for your listening pleasure. Each and every Friday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. That's www.blogtalkradio.com. And you can also reach Terry direct. Her number is 347-945-6003. That's 347-945-6003. So log in, listen, enjoy. I'll see you there.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Unmasked with authoress Terry E. Lyle and Shalanda. But before we get started, I just want to acknowledge that I'm having some power issues down here in Alabama. So if I drop off, my reliable co-host Shalanda is going to hold down the fort. But before I say all that and I'm wishing for the best, I want to welcome my special guest, Doug, number 10, Rose, and we're going to do some things, and we want to know why she called herself a 10, because, you know, when the guys are talking to me, say, ooh, girl, she's a 10, ooh-wee. So I wonder if that number has anything to do with his sexual, you know, appearance or whatever, you know, he just thinks he's at the top, but that's just another story. But I want to say hello first to my beautiful co-host, Shalonda. How are you, darling?
I'm good, Miss Terry. How are you this evening?
I'm all frazzled and dazzled and phone
right.
Working. This is all crazy. So I'm going to hang in there as long as I can. And how are you, Doug?
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful, darling. Before we get started, you know, into the meat of the conversation, now, I saw your picture, you know, and for the ladies out there that's looking and listening in, whether by computer or iPod or phone or whatever, now, Doug is kind of fine. He has a long hair. Remind me of that John Lennon thing going on. So you had that title thing for a minute. So is that because you're sexy or because you just came with the wits?
No, actually, it had nothing to do with that. First of all, let me say thanks a lot for having me on. And Shalonda, it's good to be with you both. And 10 is actually short for Tenzin Karma Trinley, which obviously nobody can pronounce, so I had to think of a real shortened version. Now, where that came from is when you go through certain Buddhist initiations, they give you a Buddhist name, and it's always something to live up to, you know. They never give you a name like idiot who pukes on his shoes or, you know, jackass who walks into walls. It's always something like, you know, something to aspire to, something that you're supposed to point yourself at and keep in mind. So my name, Tenzin Karma Trinley, means the activity of the Buddha teaching. So I figure I got to keep that. I got it in like 1981, but it's a real good device because there's only so stupid you can get when you're walking around with a name like that, right? So I kept it, but, you know, I mean, how could you be an asshole and have a name like the activity of the Buddha teaching? You know? So I got to keep track a little bit more just having that name in my brain. So I thought it was a good idea to keep it, but it's obvious that nobody can pronounce it. So 10 is really, it doesn't have to do with the number 10 or anything else like that. It just has to do with that it's short for Tenzin Karma Trinley, and that's the whole deal.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, ladies, I'm not a 10 in the conventional Derek sense.
Stop lying. Right. He looks good, okay? You need to stop lying.
Right. Thank you for saying so.
And first, let's talk about your website, fearlesspuppy.org. Where did that come from? Is that just because that was the name of the book that it became your website name, or go ahead.
Yeah, both of those things came from the same place. I wrote the book Fearless Puppy on American Road about hitchhiking around for 35 years. And where I got the, and then the website came about very shortly thereafter and picked up the same name. I called the whole project to sponsor wisdom professionals and wisdom teachers, the Fearless Puppy Project, which is what these books is all about, by the way. These books are all about. All the profits from these books are going to sponsor an increase in the number of wisdom teachers in the world, beginning with Buddhist nuns and monks, because I'm most familiar with them, but not altogether limited to them, certainly. Fearless Puppy comes from, yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question real quick. We're going to get back to that. But what a lot of people don't understand is that you do a whole lot of organizations to help other people. And when did you decide, because I know in one of your stories you were saying how you was drinking some beer before you started doing that charity for the famine in Africa. You have done a whole
right.
lot of charity organizations. When did that start in your life, and what was the catalyst for you doing that and your writing as well?
I don't know. I always had an inclination, I guess, to... I grew up in Brooklyn, and you see a lot of nasty stuff there. And it impressed me the way people would abuse each other. And I'm thinking, there's got to be a better way to live. The world must be smarter than this. And I work with juvenile delinquents and psychiatric outpatients, different stuff, for about 10, 15 years. But then I started getting into doing these projects. And the one you're describing was the first one, which was went pretty big. Governors and governor and two senators and Aaron Neville and the Boston Celtics and New England Patriots, they all eventually got involved in it, even though it started as just a small community project. But I was sitting at the bar, you know, trying to drain the world of its alcohol content, which I did a lot in the 1980s. I was in this one particular place that I used to go to a lot. And we're sitting there, and I think it was Hugh Downs on 2020 back then who first really broke that story big about the Ethiopian famine relief famine thing and how bad it was. And this was about a year or so before all the Live Aid and We Are the World and all of that stuff came around. So we're watching it on TV, and a friend of mine sitting next to me said, yeah, it's a terrible thing. It's too bad we can't do anything about it, you know? And it just suddenly struck me that, what do you mean we can't do nothing about it? You know, who's stopping anybody from doing anything, much less doing anything good? So I just got up off my drunken ass, got off the bar stool, started a little local project. A local project eventually went statewide and involved, you know, the governor and both senators and the whole teachers union got in on it and fed it through all the Massachusetts school system and everything. So, and all the money got sent to worthy places, so everybody was anxious to get involved in it. And I just started doing other projects after that. And this one here is, I think, the last and the biggest that I'll do. See, eventually I did one for homeless and for an orphanage in Mexico and for that African famine relief. But eventually, you know, Terry and Shalonda, it became obvious to me that there's a root cause to all of these things, right? And that is a lack of wisdom in the world. Mm-hmm. Because you could be smart and clever and crafty and cunning and step over a poor person, you know, lying in the street on your way to the country club to go have a party or something. But you cannot be wise and do that, because wisdom and compassion, they're wrapped in the same skin. You know, wisdom, love, compassion are all wrapped up together. You can't have one without the other. They just don't exist one without the other. So the idea came to me that instead of doing all these individual projects, which are still, I look at as very important, I mean, you have to feed people when they're not eating, you have to house people when they need shelter on an immediate basis, but the bigger root problem seemed to be that people are just freaking stupid. You know, there's just not enough wisdom in the world is what it is. Everybody's running around thinking that their own little thing is so important, and they're not getting the bigger picture. And, you know, the bigger picture is that we really are all in this together. And if one person suffers, everybody's suffering. Yeah. And to the extent that a lot of people are suffering, everybody's suffering a whole lot more. You know, and all these people with, you know, there are people who are obviously suffering and they're starving and they have no place to live and they're getting all these diseases that could be cured by medical attention, but nobody's sending them the supplies and the medicines to do it. And you get all these people who could afford to do something about this, and they're all grabbing on to their little stuff like they can take it with them after they die. You know, it's not
going to happen. And let me just say something, because you just touched on something that I really am, I've been really pondering this for a long time, for at least last month or so, where, the Ebola virus, how they brought the doctors back from Africa to Georgia and treated them for the virus, and now they're home and back happy with their family, but they can't save these thousands of people who die from the Ebola virus over in Africa. And where one guy, I know it was one guy that they didn't even permit to even come back from Africa, and he died, and his father's still trying to get his remains brought back to the United States, where they're blocking that. They won't let his body back in so that he could bury his son. And that kind of really frustrated me that, okay, I can understand that they went over there to help, but in helping, you know, you take that risk just like everybody else who has it that lives there. And they brought them back and saved them, but these people are still over there dying.
Well, yeah, it's no secret that, you know, certainly the treatment and maybe even the transmission of these diseases are politically selective.
Right.
You know, absolutely. You know, much like crack and everything else. I mean,
right.
This stuff didn't just pop out of the woodwork here.
Right.
I mean,
somebody was brilliant and said, oh, we're just going to start doing this. It didn't happen like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could look at, you know, look at all kinds of things. If you got the dough, then you can afford the treatment. And if you don't, then they won't give you the treatment.
Right.
And that's about what it comes down to. In
right.
A lot
and
of
it's
cases,
really sad. It really is sad when it comes to that.
Yeah, but it's a little too selective. But that's another thing that pops up from a lack of wisdom. See, if people had more wisdom and they were a little bit smarter, they wouldn't do dumb shit like that.
Right.
Everybody would. Really, because once you realize that that other person is no less important than you, and has just as much right to be happy and healthy as you do, then you can't hurt them because you're kind of hurting yourself at the same time. And
right.
Then just on a practical level, that's true anyways. I mean, obviously, if you keep people poor because you're hoarding all your wealth, those poor, you know, it ain't rocket science. Eventually, those people are going to want to eat to the point where they'll come and they'll kill you and take your stuff.
Right.
So that just makes perfect sense. But, that is another terrible thing that I think an increase in wisdom can solve.
Yep.
So that's why this whole thing is going on. The reason I wrote these books is because I wanted to fund this project to increase the wisdom in the world, because I think that's really the only cure for the problems that we have going on. And I never was an author. It looks like I accidentally wrote a couple of real good books because they got 25 five-star reviews on Amazon.
Accidentally?
Yeah.
Right, accidentally.
Yeah, accidentally is true, because I was just looking for something where the odds were a little better than winning the lottery, because I got to raise a lot of money to do this. But,
right.
You know, selling a million books is not an easy thing, but I accidentally wrote a couple of real good ones, it seems like, because 25 5-stars and 1 4-star
wow.
on Amazon between
right.
the two
well,
books.
That's great. That's
wow.
great.
Go ahead,
Doug. Okay, let me ask you a question, Doug. You stated that you were trying to get money to give to the wisdom teachers. Okay, now that seems so broad. Because a lot of people have wisdom. How do you define what are the people that you would give to that charity? Because I think I might just fall under that category.
You might. You actually might, you know. I'm thinking of starting with Buddhist monks and nuns because I've actually lived with them and I have a familiarity. I've seen firsthand what these people can do. And these are people, and you may also be one of them, certainly South American shamans, Native American medicine men, there's a no shortage of wisdom traditions in the world. And that's what I'm looking to help increase, because I think by having more of these smart people out there, you know, we'll get the wisdom circulated. And wisdom professionals, you ask the question, what is it? I think it's anybody who realizes what we were just talking about, that we really are all in this together. We're all one big person fragmented into, you know, billions of different people, but we're one big unit and we all have to work together. And anybody who devotes their life to make helping other people be happier and more functional within the world, and they realize that we really are all together in this, I think qualifies as a wisdom professional. So that would be my definition. So
that
you want me to go back to
that? That sounds like me.
All right. Well, there you go. You qualify. So help me sell a couple of books, and I'll sponsor you.
That's what I will. You know, I work at a college, so it ain't that hard.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah,
we need to take a little small break. We need to take a little small break. And anybody who wants to talk to our special guest, Ken Rose, dial in to 347-945-6003. If you hit the one key, that lets us know that you have a comment or a question. So get back in on this conversation, because we'll be back in 2 and 2.
Hey, you know, someone asked me recently, what do I do when I have some downtime? So I thought about it for a moment. And to mind, I think of a nice glass of wine, some candles with the right book to read. And instantly, I thought about author Terry E. Lyle, because I knew I was guaranteed to get a good laugh or some soul searching. Just like a few of her other books entitled Insane, Peeling Back the Mask, and her latest, Exposed. This author has written 9 books, and I can't pick a favorite. But my advice to you, make your own choice by going to her personal website, where she can even autograph her books for free, at www.terrylyle.com. That's www.terrylyle.com. Or go to Author House, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your local retailer, and get your copy and start your collection today. Because this is the last time I'm going to say that you can't borrow mine.
Description, baby.
cancer. And my name is Larry. And I like a woman that loves everything and everybody. And you know what, ladies? If you feel that this is you, then this is what I want you to do.
Well, I took you back into time. That was the Floaters called Float On. So I just want to thank everybody tonight that's being here with us, because it is Friday and you could be somewhere else getting your groove on, hugged up with that special someone, you know, or just, you know, vacationing or whatever it is, but you decided to hang out with us sisters. But before I go any further, I just want to thank, you know, my staff. You know, Shalonda, she bails me out when I'm going through some things. And we, you know, have an honorary staff. And one of those members is on the line right now named Lucky. She's our resident sex therapist, evangelist, anything this young lady, she could talk about it all. And then we have Tony. Mm-hmm. So I just want to thank these people, you know, that's there. Because right now, like I said, at the top of the hour, we're having some technical difficulties down here in Alabama. And I keep getting knocked off. So if there's some dead space, I hope Shalonda catch it real quick, or Miss Lucky. And also, I just want to thank everybody from north to south, east to west, you know, for supporting us, you know, by listening to the show. So I'm going to open up my mic right now for Lucky so I can introduce her to y'all. Doug, this is Lucky. This woman is dynamic. She knows a little about everything. She's my Dalai Lama.
How you doing? Hey, nice to meet you.
Why are you quiet, Lucky?
She might be muted.
Oh, she might have a phone on mute. But anyway,
you
you'll talk to her.
That 3-year-old.
Oh, yes. But we know that, Doug, you have been counseling for a few years, and you were dealing with psychiatric people. Now, let me ask you a question seriously. They say when you're around crazy, you start being crazy. Do you feel that while you were doing a counseling, some of that stuff was rubbing off on you?
When you're around crazy, you start being crazy?
Yes.
I don't know. Well, it makes it easier, that's for sure. I mean, you got to have enough structural integrity, and that's what a lot of the meditation is about, you know. You got to have enough structural integrity to hold your psychological ground. I mean, a lot of people don't take the time to pay any attention to themselves. And so it makes it easier to be driven crazy by just watching the news, much less hanging out with crazy people or whatever. I mean, there's crazy people all over the place.
Plus, some crazy people make a lot of sense.
Yeah, some of them make a lot more sense than the supposedly not so crazy people. As a matter of fact, it's the supposedly sane people who are making all the problems and dropping all the bombs. So I question that definition of sane and crazy anyways. But the point is, to it doesn't matter whether you're around crazy people or sane ones. You have to maintain your psychological structural integrity, and that's what a lot of this meditation stuff does, is to, or yoga or tai chi or whatever, anything that like centers you in your own body, so you're solid on your own feet and in your own mind, and you can't be thrown off by any either external stuff or internal stuff. I mean, look, it could come from inside your own brain, and you get stuff that could drive you wacky if you let it. But and the reason why this happens to a whole lot of people, especially in America, is that everybody's trying to fit 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag. It's not going to work, you know. There's only so much you can do. All this multitasking may be useful, but when people are doing like 20 or 30 things all at once, you can't pay attention to any one thing, and you're not paying attention to yourself. And that's where you got to go. You got to go inward. None of the answers are outside. None of that stability that people are looking for is outside of the individual person themselves. All right, so that's why just sitting still, being quiet, and breathing for 5 minutes and, like, not doing or hearing or saying anything is sounds like a waste of time, but it's a very constructive practice because it gets you centered. You know, everybody talks about, oh, the big out-of-body experience. I had an out-of-body experience. Like, that's supposed to be the big spiritual thing. But we're always having out-of-body experiences all the time, you know. You're always thinking about, oh, the husband, the boyfriend, the car, the school, the kids, whatever it is. You're constantly out of your own mind, in a manner of speaking, and it's an out-of-body experience. And the trick is actually to have an in-body experience. And so you're walking around with your brain and your body connected, and you're in touch with what's going on inside of yourself. And if you got that going on, then it makes it so much easier to comfortably and functionally relate to everything outside of yourself. But you got to have that inside thing tuned in first, you know, before you can deal with anything outside. So as far as hanging around crazy, does it make you crazy? A person can make themselves crazy in a vacuum, you know. if you're scattered all over, you are, and if you ain't, you ain't. And I would suggest to anybody who is and wants to get a little bit of a grip on it to just sit down and breathe for a little while, wow. All right, and just really not do anything and just get themselves back into their own damn body, because it's all too often that people just float away from that, and they think, you're not really in touch with yourself at that point, and that's where problems develop. So,
well, let me ask you this: you said that one day you was drinking, and at that you had an epiphany, and you wanted to do some charity for Africa. So, was that after you had given up being a counselor for psychiatric patients, or was that during the same time frame, and then when you started that charity for the recipients in Africa is when it just happened to be piggybacked on your counseling?
Yeah, I was working as a juvenile counselor at the time that I got that idea, and I started the little local project, and it grew into a much bigger thing and got to the point where I had to quit the job in the counseling center, leave the apartment I was living in. I became homeless, could go into Boston to take the thing statewide and make it work there. And, you know, I slept either in the street or in friends' houses. Eventually they ran into some people who put me up and they liked what I was doing, so they let me stay there. I stayed on other folks' living room floors and whatnot.
Doug, I'm confused. You was a counselor, and you gave being a counselor up to do that, and you chose to be homeless, or
I chose to be homeless in order to do that. I could have stayed and worked at the counseling job and kept getting paid and kept the apartment I was in. But the local project went so well that it looked like it could go a lot bigger, and actually it did, you know. And so as it grew, I just had to keep up with it. I mean, it's too much of an obligation and a responsibility. If you're, you know, getting something done that's actually keeping people from starving to death, I didn't think, there was no question. You know, there was no question in my mind. I can always get another job. But if I don't get this person food, they're not going to get another life, you know.
Right.
So first things first.
Right. Well, I think Rhonda has a question, too, for you. My co-host, she has a question.
I wanted to just ask, was your first book The Fearless Puppy?
Yeah, let's get back to that, because that was the first question you asked me, and somehow we got sidetracked for a half an hour here. But anyways, the first book is Fearless Puppy on American Road. And the book and the website and the project are all named Fearless Puppy. Where that comes from is that I was at a teaching with the Dalai Lama in Los Angeles. It was a week long. He was teaching certain Buddhist stuff. And one of the people in the audience asked the question, you know, because at the end of these things, they always let the people in the audience ask questions. So one of them asked the Dalai Lama, like, look, I feel helpless. I'm only one little person, and there's billions of people in the world. So why should I bother trying? Because what can I do? And the Dalai Lama went on to explain that even though it's true, if you're one little person in a vast community, like in New York or Los Angeles especially, in a smaller community you can make more of a dent, but it's very difficult to make a dent when you're in a high density population area, you know, with a whole bunch of people and millions of things going on all at once. But nonetheless, every bigger action has to come from individual action. There's no movement that ever happened because one person did it, all right? There was always, each person was doing their little thing, and that all added up to make that big movement, all right? And people could, you know, there could be all kinds of, like, speeches made by great individuals, but if millions of people don't march with those individuals, if millions of people don't get, like, beat up in riots and they don't fight back and they take the non, you know, if people don't participate in whatever the process is, that was just an example, but if people don't participate in whatever the process is, then nothing's ever going to get done. So we have to take individual responsibility. And right then you can see him freeze, like he just thought of something. And he laughs. He's standing up there, you know, laughing his ass off to Dalai Lama. And he goes to his translator, says something in Tibetan. The translator says, yeah, there's an old expression that sums this up in Tibet. It goes, though he or she may have low and humble status like that of a dog, yet they take great responsibility for the world, all right? And he said that's like a standard thing in Tibetan Buddhism that you're supposed to go for. You take global responsibility even though you know you're an individual. Because, I mean, it's true. I mean, you can stand there and yell at the ocean all day. Hell, you're a big, dirty ocean. You got all this crap in you. But until each drop of water in that ocean gets cleaned up, there's not going to be any big, sudden, somebody waves their hand and the ocean cleans itself up all of a sudden. And it's the same with humanity. Humanity ain't going to clean itself up all of a sudden either. It's got to be this combination of individual effort. So that fearless, that you know, take responsibility even though you have low and humble social status like that of a dog, really impressed me. But I didn't figure I was a full-grown dog yet, especially in the first book. So I called it Fearless Puppy instead. And what is that I was hitchhiking around America for 35 years, I guess. You know, I was a teenage drug dealer in Brooklyn, New York, growing up, and I was kind of obvious that that wasn't going to last too long. There were a whole bunch of complications there, as you could well imagine, And so I just decided to hell with it. I'd rather just, like, stick my thumb out and see what happens and stay here and die. So I stuck my thumb out, and the rides went so well that I didn't stop for another 35 years. And I just kept hitchhiking around. So what Fearless Puppy on American Road, the book, is 80 short chapters. It's about 350 pages, but there are 80 short chapters that tell about very interesting and interesting people.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Doug, God damn it, if I got to go over 120 pages, that's a lot of reading. Okay, but
exactly.
Let me just say this. You said that you were a psychiatric people, then you gave it up to do this charitable work. Okay, did you ever go back to an ordinary job, or did you just stay into doing fundraisers and charities and stuff like that?
Yeah, I pretty much stayed into stuff like this, if not exactly this, you know. But
how are you generating income?
Excuse me?
So how are you generating the income?
How am I generating income? I get odd jobs. I do little things that pay. My father died, and he left me a whole bunch of money. That lasted for 5 years, but it's all gone now. But during that time, I sat around and wrote the two books. And so that provided the time to be able to do that. And there was the Fearless Puppy one, which I told you about. It was about hitchhiking around for 40 years. And, there are some pretty interesting stories in there. I mean, a lot of it is meeting Native American wise men and Tibetan lamas, people like that, but a lot of the chapters are about meeting junkies and hookers and winos, too, because anything is an educational experience if you want it to be, you know.
So I
learned a lot more from hookers and winos and junkies. Right on the back of the book, I got a little blurb that says, I've been to 8 different colleges and universities, but I've learned more in other people's cars. And it's true, you know, because after 100,000 miles and like 40 years on the road, you get to meet a lot of people. And amongst them are certainly some very strong educational experiences. So that's why the book has gotten all those 5 stars, is because it's put in a Brooklyn tone, but it's got a lot of the wise men that I ran into, wise men and women that I ran into along the way. So it's kind of unusual in that it's some wise stuff, but in Brooklynese language, more or less, which I guess doesn't happen all that often. And actually, the second book is pretty much the same as well. That's Reincarnation Through Common Sense. And I spent a half a year in a Buddhist temple, but very different circumstances than most of those books. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, white boy and Asian temple books around, but this is quite a bit different in that I didn't go there to study Buddhism. I went over to Asia, and I ran into some bad times, and the monks and nuns just adopted me. Basically, they took me in and said, you could stay here. You don't have to study any of the Buddhism if you don't want to. Just go to the beach, do whatever you want. But they gave me a cabin as if I was a regular monk, a monk cabin.
That's wonderful. I was wondering about that. How do you just look up? I mean, is it like here in the States, you knock on the door of a church and say, look, I'm homeless, I need some help, and they just took you in? Because I can't imagine that I could be there and do that, and somebody just say, come on in, we'll take care of you.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit different in other countries, for one thing, and also it was even weirder than you might think, because they didn't speak any English, and I didn't speak any of their language either. So I had a friend who came and got me, and luckily he could speak both languages, and he knew the head monk at this little rural temple. I mean, way out in the boonies, dirt paths, cobras and scorpions in the road on the path going through the village and everything, and bears on the hill. So, you know, I mean, I was pretty close to death. So my friend Grammy says, I know who you got to talk to. And he took me out there and he translated a conversation with the head monk. And the head monk said, look, I'm your older brother. You can stay here. Don't worry about it. And he never asked for a dime, a prayer, or a promise, nothing. I didn't have to do. My job there was make yourself comfortable. And they just took me in and kept me for half a year. It was for like 6 months, you know. They kept me there until I was all better, and then I left. But that's what that whole book is about. But again, very unusual approach to the American Indonesian temple story, which there are several of, in that I didn't speak their language and they didn't speak mine. So the whole book is written about an experience that basically took place without words. And I had to make like 200 or 300 pages of words out of it. So it was an interesting process. And plus, I was there and not studying Buddhism. And almost every other book on the subject is by someone who expressly went to Asia to go to a temple to study Buddhism. So that's very different. And then there's a third book, actually, that I just put out on the internet for free. It's called Voices of Reason from the Ends of the World, and that can be had for free right at the fearlesspuppy.org website. And if you go there, that book's just sitting there for no charge at all. And the idea of it is to get people to look at that one, and once they see that and like the writing, then they'll buy the other two. And then the money will come in to fund the increase in wisdom professionals, and we'll all live happily ever after.
I wish that was We do have on the line, though, a guy named Tony, who is one of our honorary co-hosts, and I'm glad he's on the line, and I'm going to introduce you to him. Tony, I want you to meet our special guest tonight, Doug and Rose.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. You know, I was listening to the topic. I came in late, so I actually don't. I haven't got my bearings on it. But from what I heard, Buddhism. I have some experience with that because I have a friend of mine that had a person that was in the Buddhism that lived with them. And they did the little chant thing and whatever they had to do what they had to do. But my thing is, whatever life has for you, it's going to be what it needs to be. You know, life, you know, everybody has different visions. You know, like me, I'm a Baptist holiness. You got Buddhism. You know, but life has different turns for everything. And what we need to do is get into ourselves and know what we need to do to make life productive for us. Because one thing we need to know, life ain't going to give you nothing. You have to get out there and get it. And if you don't reach out and get it for yourself, and you don't have that mind to exceed, then you're lost in life anyway.
Yeah, well, some people, they won't get it for themselves. They try to steal yours.
Right.
But I'm saying, you know, my thing is you have to get out there and get it. You know what I'm saying? Because everybody have different things that we have to do. You know, people think this way, I think this way, you think another way. But in end results, life is a life experience to grab a hold and do what you have to do. Because poverty, a lot of people say poverty, oh, man, you know, I'm here and I'm there and I ain't making it, I ain't doing it. Poverty is what you make it, because you can achieve an above, past your problems and make things better for you. But if you go into yourself and just say, well, okay, what I'm feeling sorry for myself, you can't do that. Because I'm a blind guy. I don't feel sorry for myself. I rise above it all. You know what I mean? Because I get out there, I roam, and I do, and I learn my community where I live in. I walk around, and they see me walking around. You know what I mean? So you just can't give up. You know, you can't give up. You can't give up. And you don't even want to give in. You want to just achieve. No, you don't want. Don't give up and don't give in. Just achieve.
I agree with you 100% there.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we need to take another small break, and we're going to be back in 2 and 2. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Eventually, the truth will come out of the darkness for everyone to see.
Hello? Hey, it's Mike. Hey, how y'all doing? Oh, yeah, everything's good. Just been really busy. Sorry I haven't been here this week. Yeah. I forgot, but I will be there this week. Right now.
There are times in your life when your faith will be challenged.
Hey man, I want to share something with you. I accepted Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior. He's been really wonderful to me. Don't you agree?
I feel like I'm my own guy. The things that's been happening to me, I feel like I've been making those things happen.
Wait a minute. You mean to tell me you don't believe in God?
Well, I haven't seen him.
The truth can come in shocking form.
Nobody up in my house when I'm at work all day.
No! Who is this? Why is he in my house?
Who are you, man?
Is this your mom?
Who are you? Mother, this is my woman and this is my house.
Oh, honey,
my girlfriend. Why is he in this house? What do you mean you didn't know?
When the secret is no longer hidden, you have now been exposed. Written by authoress Terry E. Lyle. Check out her website and on Blog Talk Radio every Friday at 7:30 p.m.
Voila. Thank God it's Friday night and I just
the point.
on the mic, yo, I'm unstoppable and it's probable. When you hear our voices laid down, you'll be bobbing your head to this stereotype sound. You need your thought that you had me flooded. Check is in the mail, I got it made. And when you notice some smile, it's like cool day, cause I just got paid.
On the floor, rocking to the beat. Always show looks sweet. Find a young lady standing by. Come on, baby, sweet, I delight. So you look so sweet when you're moving to the beat. I'm tired of all these boring parties, baby. Why don't we get on down? Let's get on down. A Friday night.
Shalanda, and it's Friday, and like the song by NSYNC, you just got paid. So some of y'all out there trying to get into some trouble, but my advice is to take your little nappy behind somewhere, sit it down, and be safe. If you're drinking and doing drugs, don't drive, okay? Don't do that, you know. But I just want to give a shout-out to some people. I want to say hi to Wayne Ditchville in Australia. I'd like to say hi to Mary Glasgow and Iron Moody out of the United Kingdom. And I want to say hi to Philip Robinson, his next-door neighbor Cheryl, his friend Jerome Everlasting, kicking it in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in the heat, making it do what it do. And I just want to welcome back my guest, Doug, who as a teenager in Brooklyn, New York, he was selling drugs, and then he got himself a good little job for like about 15 years. He was a counselor for people who had psychological problems, juveniles. And then one day while he was drinking, he had an epiphany. He was going to start some fundraising for the famine situation in Africa. He did that. And so he'd been doing his little thing. Then he decided that after his dad passed away and left him loaded, you know, for 5 years, he ran through that money, pat, pat, pat. But then he started writing some books. But now, I don't know what you're doing now, but you do a lot of different things. So if you're looking for a handyman, he's your man. So welcome back, Chad, to the show. Oh, how are you doing, baby?
Doing all right. Doing all right.
I think
I'll stick with this writing thing for a while.
Right.
Okay, yeah. Well, you said that you came about doing a fundraiser for Africa because you were drinking. Are you drinking tonight?
No.
Okay, well.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, because, you know, a little lift here and there will help the wheels in your brain get to moving in different directions. You never know. And I see that my co-host. She has a question. She laying back there in the cut.
I do, because I'm just so, I'm awed by the fact that he hitchhiked for 35 years.
It's like I was telling him before the show, once I learned how to drive, that was it for me. You would never catch me, like, walking. I have owned a car. Right. I owned a car for so many years. I can't live without my transportation. I need my four wheels to go when I get on in it and I want it to go. But through your experiences through hitchhiking, like, what was one of the experiences that stick with you the most? Like, what interaction with a person that sticks with you the most today through your hitchhiking? Because I know that you met with the Dalai Lama and then with Buddhist monks and things like that. But what was, like, just for an average American person?
You know, those prostitutes and drug dealers, remember? I mean, because
right.
He knows his street life.
Yeah, well, there were a lot of them. I tell you the truth, it's hard to pin down just one, but because there's like I said, about 80 different episodes, like you're asking for here in the book. But the one that people seem to like the most is about when I got picked up hitchhiking by the members of an all-lesbian rock and roll band, and they took me to where they were playing a concert for deaf people. Now,
wow.
I don't mean that they were playing a concert and there was people who could hear paying money and it was a benefit for deaf school or something. No, they were actually playing a concert for people who were deaf. And
wow.
that was one of the classic experiences of my life as far as I'm concerned. And it seems to be one of the most popular stories in the book, in Fearless Puppy on American Road, too. It was just an incredible thing. I mean, they took me there, and, you know, this was a long time ago. I was hitchhiking around, so there really weren't that many lesbians around to begin with. To find five of them in one place that all played their instruments and were performing together was a really unique experience under any circumstances
mm-hmm.
in America back, like, 4 or 5 decades ago. So to have them then,
Doug, if the people they were playing for were deaf, what were they doing? Did they have a screen where someone was sign languaging to the beat of the
no.
music or the instrument?
No,
it's just basically the bass of the music. As long as they could keep the rhythm to the music, it helped them. We used to have deaf neighbors that lived next door to us when we lived on Reisterstown Road in Baltimore. And they used to come to our parties and everything, and they would ask my brother to turn up the bass so that they could feel the vibration of the music.
Well, for one thing, it's the vibration. But for another thing, these were people who had hearing before and had lost it. They weren't born deaf.
Oh, okay.
So, they had some kind of a touchstone frame of reference kind of thing. But also, it's like you say, they can feel the vibrations, and they could just, they just got the feel of it. It was like they were hearing, but they weren't using their ears, you know.
Okay, well, we got a guest, Doug, Miss Lucky. She wanted to ask you a question, but after she asked you that question, I'm going to get back to that, because other than vibrations, was it just a plain visual thing? Because I can't imagine how you could play a group for a deaf group. I mean, what else? Was it just a visual that they saw the people there? You know?
No, it's a sense thing. I mean, look, if you're out in the sun, you could feel the sun on your skin, right?
Right.
You could have your eyes closed. You know that the sun is shining down on your skin. Well, it's the same thing with this. You know, the music is loud. It's moving the air. And there's vibratory things going on in the atmosphere. And these people are so sensitized. Look, whenever you can't use one sense, another sense gets very heightened. All right? So, like, if you would go blind, your hearing would be real sharp. If you would go deaf, then your sight would be real sharp because other senses compensate. So they have this other sensibility about them that, you know, people who...
The monk's right on the line here, Tony, he's visually impaired. And he said that, you know, people tell them he's washing their hands or not.
Oh, we're starting to get echo.
Yeah, there was an echo there.
Yeah, I couldn't really tell what you were saying because it's echoing.
Okay, I said my honorary co-host, Tony, who was on the line, by him being visually impaired, he said he can be in a different room and he can tell if someone was flushing the toilet, not because you're close, like you hear the sound. He can hear vibration. His ears are so deep, man. He could probably hear rap piss on cotton, you know?
Yeah.
It's so intense, you know? But we do have Lucky on the line. Do you want to ask you a question?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. I'm very blessed. How about you?
Oh, everything's going just fine. Thank you very much.
Okay. I got a couple of things. Miss Terry asked you first. Miss Terry asked you a little bit ago, if you were drinking, and you answered her, but you hesitated. So I wanted to just ask you, are you sure? Because I promise we won't tell anybody. I promise we won't tell anybody.
There's a lot of interference. I'm not sure where it's coming from.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to
hear it too.
I heard something about, are you drinking? Are you asking Terry, Sholanda, or me?
No, I was asking you. I said Terry asked you a little bit ago if you were drinking, and I said you hesitated when you answered. And then I said,
well,
if you are, it's okay. I promise we won't tell anybody.
Oh, I don't care if you tell anybody. You can tell everybody if you want.
He said not yet. He said not yet.
Yeah, not yet.
He said not yet. Okay.
Yeah, I think when the show is over, I'll have a glass of wine. You know,
okay.
I mean, there's drinking and there's drinking. That doesn't, you know, not everybody who has a drink goes out and drinks 10 bottles of whiskey and runs their car up a tree. I'm not that kind of drinker.
What? I just know everybody doesn't go and get blasted.
Yeah.
You know, that's okay. But
yeah, some people just have a sociable drink, you know.
Indeed. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the concert for the deaf people. And
right.
When I was growing up, I had a friend who was deaf, and rather her parents were deaf, and they used to go to concerts, so I understand that. But in all of your travels and all of the things that you've done, you know, you said you used to sell drugs. Was there ever any point where you were using the drugs that you were selling or?
Oh, a lot of them. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, all the time.
Were any of your trips? I'm sorry, go ahead.
You can't name a drug that I didn't do. I doubt it.
Okay.
Wow.
I mean, I was.
Then he sound like my brother.
No, I was addicted to heroin for a year and a half, and eventually overdosed and died. Actually, was pronounced dead at the hospital. They had to give me a second shot of adrenaline to bring me back because the first shot didn't work, and they said I was dead. And then some other doctor said, "No, give him another shot," and they gave me another shot, and I came back. But also shot speed, cocaine. I mean, any and everything. Yeah.
Okay. So now the trips that you describe in your book, where you've traveled and hitchhiked for, my brother still hitchhikes, and he's still addicted to drugs, and so I understand that concept. But I just want to know, were any of the trips that you described trips that you had while you were on acid or any type of drug that you may or may not be able to tell if these things really happen? And I'm not being funny. I'm just asking because I know that some folks who have had trips that they believe are real that weren't. So I'm just asking.
I never got that far out, you know. I mean, I've done 500 tabs of acid, 500 trips. Some of them were actually mescaline, and some were peyote buttons, and some were magic mushrooms, some were LSD. But I've done 500 trips altogether. This is all before 1980. I haven't done any of this stuff since 1980, I guess, was like the last time I even dabbled in hard drugs, you know. But I've
done
a lot of them.
So now you only dabble in soft
ones? Yeah, exactly. And I've never had an experience where I didn't know for sure that this was happening. I mean, you hear the stories about this kind of thing, but I've never heard it from anybody who's done any acid. Like they had an experience and they ended up not having that experience. You know, I've never heard about it. I mean, obviously you have, but I don't know. Maybe the stuff I was getting was weaker. maybe my mind was stronger. You know, some people take this stuff and they jump off of buildings.
Indeed,
know?
Indeed.
And some people jump off of buildings without taking this stuff, and maybe if they took it, they wouldn't have jumped off the building. So, you know, I mean, I can't understand that. Actually, if you want to jump off a building, you know, if you think you can fly, why don't you take off from the ground? You don't see ducks. Do you see ducks lining up to catch elevators to go fly south for the winter from the roof?
Right.
They take off from the ground. So, I mean, this doesn't have much to do with LSD. This has to do with somebody being crazy.
Right.
You know?
Indeed.
Yeah,
you okay, Shalonda?
I'm tripping. I have always said that. Why would somebody go to the top of a building to jump because they think they can fly when all birds take off from the ground?
I've never seen a run and start. I've never seen a duck in an elevator.
My thing is this. People that do drugs. I mean, I never did hard drugs. The only thing I ever done was weed and drink, right?
Mm.
And I still drink now. But I'm like my homeboy that, you know, I drink when I want to drink. When I don't want to drink, I don't have to. You know, I'm a controlled substance drinker. You know,
you're a functioning alcoholic.
You know what I'm saying? So my thing is, you know, I do it because that's what I want to do to relax. I'm a blind individual, so I do that. When touching about vibrations and deaf people, being blind, you know, sometimes, you know, I was at Target one time. And a girl walked past me. I didn't see her. But the way she walked, I know that girl had an ass on her, boy. Because it was the way she was walking. I mean, it was, that's not what that is. But she was
I get that. That's why I'm laughing.
Look, my buddy said, how do you know that? I said, man, it's the way she was walking. I know that thing was heavy, and it was right. And he looked at me and said, but you blind? I said, no. I just heard the way she walked past me. And plus, she swiped me. So I had a little feel of that ass, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, you can feel a lot of things through blindness, not being able to hear. Because I have some people that can't hear. But when you said it, even me, I didn't hear, but that vibration hits you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can get with that brutal, man. You can get with that. So, I mean, you know, it's the individual and how they exceed and accept things. Me, I accept things all the way because I'm blind. So I tap into all areas, you know. I use my senses of hearing. Then I use my senses of seeing because I picture things in my mind.
Right.
You know, when I walk through a mall and one of them girls that got them big, nice asses hit me, I know she got something, but she sounds like that. Just knowing what you have, you know. You have to deal with what you have. You know, like me being blind. That's being home, you know. I know every inch of my apartment. I clean every inch of my apartment. When we have what they call apartment inspection, when these guys come to look at my place, they don't even come in. But they say, why I'm coming in? Because we want to catch up. your stuff is fixed. So we need to see somebody that got something wrong, you know. So every senses, you know, works each other senses. If you're blind, you got another sense, so you tap into another thing. If you deaf, you got another thing that you do. You know what I'm saying? The sign language, or just maybe reading lips or whatever. You able to, you know, be able to adapt in society, you know. So my thing is, you know, we good with what we do, you know. And I'm good with what I do. You know, I don't do drugs, never done it, but guess what? I drink when I want to.
And that's true, because I know that my son's father, he went blind, and I always argue with him because he waits till the nighttime to want to walk to the store, and he's blind. And he said he feels more comfortable walking at nighttime because he's blind, because it makes his world seem, because he can see, like, the color of, like, he'll know it's light outside, but he can't, like, tell who is in front of him.
I can do the same thing, Shalana. I know light from dark. But sometimes when I walk around my complex, I like to go out at night and just walk around.
That's what he does. And it drives me crazy. Yeah, it drives me crazy. You can ask, like, it drives me crazy that he does that. But that's his comfort zone.
But if you think about with your son's father, though, he preferred to be out at night before he went blind. So that was always his comfort zone, and people tend to migrate to what they were comfortable with. Wait a minute, Tony.
I prefer to be out in the daytime. I didn't want to be out at night when I could see.
Hello. So it's not about vision impairment. We got to give that to Doug.
That's right.
We apologize.
Well, no, but he made several good points. I mean, whenever you have one sense that's lessened, then the other senses come up to make up for it. So no doubt the brother has more, you know, intense. He could hear things that you and I couldn't hear, you know, just because of other senses kicking in when one kicks out. And I guess that was pretty similar to what happened at that concert for the deaf. But I actually had a conversation with these people between sign language, pointing at things, holding up fingers, and I mean, I found out how many kids they had and how old they were, and, you know, when they met this couple that I was sitting with, and all kinds of things about them, and told them all kinds of things about me. So that was really an eye-opening experience, and it was, you know, that's one of the favorite stories that people seem to like in the book. There's another one about Ejection Eddie. There's a guy who got thrown out of the draft board and got thrown out of places that people usually don't get thrown out of. He got thrown out of the draft board, he got thrown out of jail, and he got thrown out of a mental hospital. People usually get kept in those places, but this guy got thrown out of all three of them. So, you know, so there are some, Fearless Puppy on American Road. All the information about it and the other two books, the free book is over there also at fearlesspuppy.org, you know, www, everything's www, but www.fearlesspuppy.org. And there are sample chapters from Fearless Puppy on American Road, sample chapters from Reincarnation Through Common Sense. There's about 100 interviews, different newspaper articles about the previous projects that have been done, information about this project to sponsor the Wisdom Professionals. So if anybody's interested in any of that, they can find it all right there.
Okay.
What currently are you working on? What charity are you dealing with now? Or have you just kind of like put that to the side for right now?
Well, I just finished the third book and put it up on the internet for free to try to attract people to the other two. So I'm working.
The charities. She's talking about the charities. Which charities are you working with now? Or are
I'm not working
with
any now. I'm waiting for the money to come in from the people. Got to start buying books before I start working with any charities. All right, there's no money for me to give to anybody yet. So that's the whole point.
Sometimes you just volunteered your time as well. I thought that maybe you volunteered or spearheaded some, got them organized and up and running as well.
Now, usually I invent, well, I did work for Greenpeace for 13 years, and for another group I volunteered for was Citizens Awareness Network, where they're, in another environmental group. But basically what I've been doing is inventing and organizing my own type of charity projects. Now, a lot of the money, like, for example, I invented and organized that whole African famine relief thing, and it went statewide and went pretty big, but all the money got sent to different organizations. I didn't even touch any of that money. I just put everything together and made it work, but I had the people send their contributions to either Save the Children or UNICEF and different groups, the Red Cross, different groups that were specifically dealing with the Ethiopian famine relief, and had them earmark that contribution that it was supposed to go for the Ethiopian famine relief. And so for that one, I just passed it through other charities. All right, for this one here, when these books start selling and all the money comes in, I'm going to take the book and take the money and distribute it myself, as opposed to sending it through other organizations.
Okay.
So, but
can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Okay. I'm thinking about this hitchhiking thing. My brother does this, like I said, all the time, and it always freaks me out. We watched the movie The Hitcher when we were younger, and so I always think these horrible thoughts. Was there any point in time where you got in a situation where there was trouble and you had to get out of it, or you ever thought that you might end up with a serial killer or any of that?
You said you watched The Hitcher, and that ever since you've been terrorized at hitchhiking, and people watch the news, and they're afraid to go out the door and always looking over their shoulder, walking. I said, stop, turn that shit off. Really, turn that shit off.
I understand that, but
this is mind poison here. This is mind poison. The human central nervous system is not designed to take everything that went wrong in the whole fucking world into it in the course of 30 minutes. All right, this is going to blow your circuitry. And that's a lot of what's wrong with people today is they're getting fed so much negativity constantly.
Right, and nothing positive. Right,
constantly,
I understand that.
You know,
but
and so like this will just toast your brain. You got to get off of that. And to answer your question, I had one time in like 35, 40 years, well over 100,000 miles, I had one time that I got picked up by this ignorant-ass redneck trucker at the Virginia-North Carolina border who told me, we don't have, you know, and I had long hair at the time. This was like 1970 or 71 or something. So I had long hair, and I was with a woman who obviously looked a little bit hippied out, you know. And this like, animal is just a gorilla. He's driving us down this dark road, telling us we don't have no hippies or niggers in my little town. You know, I said, "Oh, get me the fuck out of here!" You know, I almost jumped out of the truck while it was rolling. But finally, he pulls into a truck stop, and I get out and I said to my partner, says, "Mary, we ain't going no further with this lunatic." And he said, "Yep, that makes sense to me." And so I go back out to get the duffel bag out of the truck, and as I'm grabbing it, I can see through the window one of the guys that the trucker was talking to inside the truck stop loading a revolver and he gets out to the side and he goes and sits in his car over there. So they were waiting for us to get back in the truck, and they were going to take us and do whatever they wanted with her and probably blow me away quick and her a little bit slower. All right? But you got to remember, this was in the South during 1970. Things were by far not as good as they are today. Not that they're great today. But by far, you know. But think about the odds now. Think about the odds, all right? We're talking about 100,000. Maybe I got in and out of 100,000 cars and trucks, all right? And this happened once. What other odds? Okay. You could, and most people, if you cross a street 100,000 times, you're going to get hit by a car once, you know?
I
really had no more trouble hitchhiking than you would walking down the street. But I tell you, it made a difference, I'm pretty sure, starting out in the 1960s, because if somebody tried to do this now, I think it would be a whole lot more difficult for them, because there's a lot less. Back then there was a trust, there was a feeling of things were working, you know, things were growing in the right direction. There was civil rights,
and people weren't whacked
rights,
the fuck
gay
out.
Rights. Yeah, well, no, they weren't
people
just
would...
as whacked out. We had as many crazy
they,
people
they were
back
whacked
then
out
as
then.
We
it
do
was
now.
A different kind of whack. It was a different kind
it
of whack.
It wasn't as publicized. It wasn't as publicized. You didn't have a shutdown.
Right. Well, now,
throat.
See, now people are doing it for publicity. People are doing it because they feel like it. Oh, I'm out of cigarettes. Let me go kill somebody.
No, people are doing
it
because now they're exposed to the idea. You know, if you had a town where somebody got, say, their head cut off, that information was in that town back in those days. But now that'll go from that one town all the way across
everywhere.
The world.
Right.
You know, within 5 minutes. So now people are more exposed to the idea of what people, what things people could do to other people. Where, you know, back in the day, people used to do, like, mean things to animals and cats and dogs. But now that they see that people are actually doing it to other humans, let me try it. And it's spread across the world now. Everybody thinks that, you know, just like the stupid challenges, all these dumb challenges, and now we've been flipping it to positive stuff now. But people used to do, like, the dumb cinnamon challenge, like, for real.
Right,
you want to get yourself pneumonia with the cinnamon challenge, you know, stuff like that. And they go across the world that way. So, you know, now that we have all this negative stuff that's going on, everybody wants a piece, and everybody wants their turn at publicity. So, you know, people who already got a psychotic thinking in their minds are now exposed to this information, and now they go and try to one-up the other, you know, the craziness of somebody else, and one-up or follow behind the craziness of another person. So that's...
Yeah. I also think, though, that people are a lot more afraid now because it's so publicized. People are afraid to just be nice, to be courteous, to be kind, to give somebody a ride, to say, okay, well, come on, you know, I think that people are afraid to pick somebody up on the side of the road because of all the negativity they hear. They see somebody on the side of the road, well, I'm not going to pick you up, but I'm going to hit your ass, you know.
Right. I run you down. You know me. I run you down.
Right.
When you get knocked out, I break you down.
Wait
a minute, y'all. Terry's trying to ask a question.
Okay.
Hey,
Doug,
go ahead, Terry.
Remember when you saw the guy loading up his gun and you went back to get your bag out the truck, did the guy give you any resistance from trying to get the bag out the truck?
Well, no, because he wasn't in the truck. He was still in the diner. Now, once I got the bag out and back into the diner from the bay where he had it parked, you know, I got the bag back in. Then we're in the middle of a diner with a bunch of other people. So he couldn't say nothing at that point.
He wasn't in the truck, so you just went in, snatched your stuff, and y'all left.
Yeah, I went out there, got the stuff, brought it back in, and he was still inside. But one of the guys he was talking to inside was outside loading the gun.
Wow.
So that's how I knew they were up to no good. But again, I mean, you got to look at the odds. The odds are just as good. You get hit crossing the street or doing anything 100,000 times, something's going to go wrong. And I must have got in and out of 100,000 cars over the course of 35, 40 years, you know. So
wow.
it really didn't work out too badly at all. And I got picked up by one woman, ended up spending 2 years with her. You know?
What?
And plus in the late 60s, early 70s, yeah, every ride was a rolling party anyways.
Right.
You know, it was a lot more fun back. There was just a general feeling of hope. I mean, you could see that, you know, all the rights movements were moving in the right direction. We actually got the Vietnam War stopped. There was constructive, hopeful things going on there, and people were in a better mood. And since, you know, I mean, it's no secret they killed off all the real leaders that we had in this country around that period of time and put in all the puppets they could find. Oddly enough, we've been doing that to other countries, and now we did it to ourselves finally. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so things aren't as much fun as they were back then in a number of different ways, and I think hitchhiking definitely falls into that, you know, into that category of things that used to be more fun, but sort of got screwed up, along with the rest of the culture.
Right. So how did you get to Asia? How did you get there
from being a hitchhiker? Yeah, I didn't hitchhike to Asia.
Right.
I got on an airplane to do that, like most people do.
I mean, did you, like, pay for a ticket, or did you, you know, stow away, or?
No, I paid for a ticket.
Okay, so that was just your choice to go? That was just your choice to go to Asia?
I wanted to go someplace very different than America, and that's all the way on the other side of the world. And also, I went to Thailand, and Thailand is one of the very, very few countries in the whole world that has never been conquered by a European power. I mean, all around them, you got Burma, now it's Myanmar, but that was a British colony, and Laos was French, and Vietnam was French, and then Indonesia was everything. And so all these countries, and of course all of Africa, all of South America, was at one time or another colonized, including America, at one time or another colonized by a European power. And so I wanted to go somewhere where there was more of a chance of seeing an actual indigenous culture before westernization and McDonald's screwed with them and the planet became the third mall from the sun that it is today, you know. But so that's what made me want to go there. I wanted to see that some kind of culture without the influence of the Western world. As different as it can get anyways nowadays. So that's why I went there. And it it didn't disappoint because it's a very different place.
That's
a very
cool.
Different place. They got different ideas about a whole lot of things. So.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention that the language is just...
So was it... How long were you in Asia before you went to before the monks helped you?
I went to the temple. I was in Asia, in Thailand, a year and a half. And for 1 year of that, I wasn't in the temple. And then the last half year that I was over there is when I spent that time in the temple.
And how did you get back to America if you were sick and ill? Did they help you
transport
back?
Yeah, finally a couple of friends sent me enough money for a plane ticket back.
Oh, okay.
And then I came back and started over again, and everything was hunky-dory. But when I left, I had already started writing, and I told the guys there, I said that, I see what you guys can do. Because it was not only for me, I mean, they completely fixed me. But you can see it in the little village there, you know, just amongst the local people. People would come into the temple, like, screaming and all pissed off and everything and ready to kill somebody. And then they go and talk. talk to a monk or a nun for, I mean, these people are like psychologists, you know, and they talked to them for 15 minutes and all of a sudden they felt all better. And I can see them walking out with a smile on their face where they walked in looking like they were going to chop somebody up with a machete.
Mm.
I mean, a lot of what people don't understand is that Buddhism isn't really a religion. You know, it's a school of thought.
Right.
It's a
right.
psychological way of looking at things. It can be a religion, but there's also scientific and psychological Buddhism, which is not a religion at all. And as a matter of fact, we have so many Jewish Buddhists that the term Jubu got invented. There's so many Quaker Buddhists that the term Quackaboo got invented. So there's people, because there's no creator God in Buddhism. It doesn't interfere with any religion. So
right.
people from a lot of other religions do it anyways as like a psychological mind training kind of practice. So that's more of what I saw, and that's what got me on this whole wisdom professional gig here, is that I can see the effects that these people who took the time and trouble to care enough about humanity altogether to go and take that job on as their way of life. They were just going to go help people, and their job description is to be compassionate and to help folks whenever they can. And you can see that stability, that mental calm in there from being in that place mentally, that when angry people walk into it, it's like they get washed over and all their garbage gets washed out of the system, and they feel happy and smiley again and walk out. Not all the time, but most of the time that I observed it anyways. Not
right.
to mention what I observed them doing for me. So that's really what got me on the whole thing, and I plan to go back there and help those people expand their operation if I ever do sell a million books or win the lottery or whatever. Because, they do amazing things. And again, it's not like they have no aggressive recruiting policy. Not only doesn't anybody come around and try to make you become a Buddhist, but you have to go and ask them for a teaching. They won't do it otherwise.
Right.
They won't just like run into somebody on the street and start teaching them. You have to go and make an actual request for that in order to get it. So,
well, Dad,
yeah.
told us that we need to take a little small break real quick. And so stay with us. We'll be back in 2 and 2.
Okay.
My after all this time. Slip on your nightcap, step in our bedroom, 'cause I wanna take some time. I just wanna look at you. Girl, you are so fine, I can't believe my eyes. And all that I wanna do, a minute more to come, and I'm so proud to be with you, so proud to share your love. I wanna say credit cards.
All products have a money-back guarantee on all fully unused containers. Make your choice today. And oh, don't forget, when the mood is right and you're relaxed, then listen to Unmasked with Terry E. Lyle every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio. Well, if you excuse me, I like to get back to making it do what it do, baby. Peace.
Well, welcome back to Unmasked with authors Terry E. Lyle and Shalinda. I've been having some technical difficulties on my end down here, and I thank God for Shalinda and my resident evangelist, resident counselor, this young lady, so dynamic. She does a lot of things. Her name is Lucky, and also my honorary co-host, Tony, for trying to fill in through the gaps. So I apologize up front for any audio issues that we're experiencing tonight. But I just want to feedback a little bit on that commercial you just heard about my 10 perfumes that I have off the women. I'm happy to announce that I also have started my men's collection, and one hot off the press is called Hot Stuff. And if you're an Aramis man, you'll definitely love this because I put a little twist to it. So I'm glad that y'all here with us, and I'm glad that my Doug 10 Rose is here, and I just want to get you back and use this opportunity for everyone to give a shout-out. And if you're on the air with us and you want to give a shout-out, hit the number one key, and I'll open up your mic. So I want to welcome back my guest. And how you doing, Doug?
All right, and you?
I'm just wonderful. I've been here to hear most of it, but I've been popping on and off, so hopefully I won't have this issue next week. And how are you, Lucky?
I'm so well, thank you.
Thanks.
Great to be here, and glad that you're back with us.
Okay, and how's my favorite girl, Shalinda? Baby, you got your phone on me.
So you know the children came in for football practice because my phone is on. But I'm still here. They ain't killed me yet. I'm still here.
And I don't see Tony. I think he dropped off. But we're going to let Dad give his shout out, anything he would like to say. And then we're going to go to Lucky and then to Shalinda and then me, unless someone who's listening, hit the number one key. Let's we know that you want to say something before we get off the air.
All right. Well, being as we're in the last segment here, I might as well tell folks where they can find everything one more time. www.fearlesspuppy.org. That's fearless and puppy, spelled just like they sound, .org. Has sample chapters from Fearless Puppy on American Road book, sample chapters from Reincarnation Through Common Sense book, also information on how to order them directly through the website. There is a free book there, Voices of Reason from the Ends of the World, and that's to entice you to buy the other two books. So if you read that one and you like it, then there's plenty more where that came from. There is also information on the project, which is the only reason why these books have been written. They are a funding vehicle. All the profits from the sales of the books go to sponsor wisdom professionals and wisdom teachers in the hopes that we can get a little bit less stupid and eventually, as a species, probably survive with any luck. That's about it. There's a bunch of newspaper articles, background information. Senator Kerry read me into the congressional record. That's up there, a citation from the Giraffe Society, and all kinds of other stuff. But, again, you can see it all without me having to bend your ear about it at www.fearlesspuppy.org.
Oh, that's wonderful, Doug. Lucky, darling, you're up.
very quickly, Doug, have you, you know, there are a lot of people who will listen to a book but won't read them. Have you considered getting your books onto audible.com so that people who prefer to listen or people who are blind have the availability and opportunity to share in your work?
It's a great idea, and I certainly have been thinking about it. I haven't gotten to it yet, but it's going to get done. But, yeah, that's an excellent idea.
Yeah,
I'm glad.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And I look forward to when that happens. I thank you, as always, Ms. Terry and Shalonda, for allowing me to be part of the show. I love y'all dearly. And, you know, y'all make me smile.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. It was wonderful to meet you and to hear your stories and your point of view on some things, because you're right, there are a lot of dumb asses out here, and I'm glad that somebody recognizes it besides us. I do love that, and you're right, people need to wake the fuck up. So
yeah,
I thank you for being on the show with Ms. Terry and Shalonda tonight. It was a lot of fun and very informative, and
yeah, I'm glad
I had a great
here
time.
Too.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we're going to go to Philip in Florida.
Yes. I like this show.
On.
Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Yeah. I like to say, yeah, it was so informative. I dated blind people and the deaf people. You know. I also hitchhiked a lot of time too, but I always had God would be with me for a lot of time, so I don't worry about being mistreated or abused on highway because.
Amen.
Because my power is in God. You know, He always look out for me when I couldn't do better. He always watch over me. Me and my sister, you travel all the time. You know, but I love traveling. You know, sometimes I just like get on the road, get my money, and get on my car, and just travel, just travel, you know. But I've been blessed, you know. I had a spiritual awakening last night. I don't complain, but too much anymore because of, I know God got me, you know. So if you got God, you can do anything to Christ who strengthens
me. That's right.
So
that's right.
So, my sister. It's my biggest fan, you know, because I'm glad I can see her putting her eye in the all, put her eye in the fire. She has so many eye in the fire. She awesome. And Lana, you too, and Lucky, all y'all are excellent. What y'all do? So y'all,
thank
I wish y'all
thank
the
you.
Best of luck. Everything you do, you know, because y'all are
thank
awesome.
Thank you.
And God bless
and
you.
Yeah, thank you. And God,
and,
you know.
Also, and one more thing to say, you know, I just came home from a meeting, though, you know, how you do, I've been clean 11 years. I went back out one time before. I should have 20 years, but no, but now I'm clean and sober. I don't even think about getting high or drinking or anything else no more because God say I don't have to do that no more. So,
right.
So I'm blessed by that.
Yeah,
I thank God that's good because, you know, once you go back out there, sometimes you won't recover. So if you did,
right.
If you had
that's
it with
right.
your drugs and stuff, you know, once you get clean, stay clean because the next time you're going to get caught up and can't get back.
Right.
That's right.
Don't make it back. Don't make it back. So I've been blessed. I'm blessed.
Yeah, me and Shalonda are the one and Carmen. I don't think made it back, but, you know, that's another story. But, Shalonda, this is your hour.
I'm going to get you in. Oh, goodness. I'd just like to thank Tim for being our guest this evening. It was very informative and interesting for me. Because it was one of those things that I would love to, I don't know if I would hitchhike, but I would love to just travel and just keep going without the worry of having to pay
you
bills and take care of children. I ain't never hitchhiked. Would you?
We hitchhiked all the way back to Park Heights. What you talking about?
That wasn't hitchhiking. I was talking all the way back across town. But, you know, it's just something that I would have loved to do is just travel from state to state to state to state. I've never been out west, and I want to start going that way instead of north to south all the time. No pun intended, Lucky. But I'd
if
like
you,
to thank
if
you.
If you read that Fearless Puppy book, you can take the whole trip without leaving the farm.
I want to have my own fun because, see, our fun may be a little different.
Right. Yeah, I hope so for your sake.
Right. So
and
I
hope so for your
fun.
Sake, Doug.
No, thank you.
And I'd like to thank Ms. Terry, as always, for providing the avenue for us to be able to have these types of discussions on Friday night.
Indeed.
And I
want
to thank
Indeed.
Every single student who signed up to be my staff for the help desk at Howard University because this summer has been something special. And now that I have more help, I feel that much more empowered because it was two of us for the whole summer to handle the whole university and half the hospital. And it's been a rough road, and I thank God for the student tip.
Yeah. I also would like to say thank you, Ten, for being a guest on our show. And you know, this is like home. You're always welcome to come back. But I first want to let everybody know next week, be with us because our guest is going to be a guy who sort of shroud of Turin, the burial cloth that was over Jesus, and how he felt a miracle. So it's going to be a great topic to, next week, by the 17th Shroud of Turin. So get your Bibles out, get your little religious caps on, because we're going to discuss a miracle and the proof that is real, you know. So it's going to be a very riveting show next week. And as well, we got so many good things coming down the pipe. I want y'all to be here at 7:30. Tell your friends. Just call in at 347-945-6003. You don't have to make no comment. You don't have to ask a question. Then, you know, or go online and do it. But as always, we appreciate the listeners that have tuned in to listen to our show. And if you got any show ideas or you would like to be a guest, just hit me up at 443-956-8753, and I'll get you on my roster. So thank you again for all of y'all hanging with us. And, Ken, I love you. And you
I love you, too. Thanks very much for having me. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. And everybody
anytime,
who's
darling.
Been there tonight, it's been always nice to meet a whole group of wonderful people all at once like that.
Well, bless your
oh,
heart.
That's so special. He thinks we're wonderful.
I do. I actually
I
do. I'm not just
I am.
That
I don't know about you.
They are wonderful.
Well,
they really are.
Yeah. That's well, all right. I love you, folks. Good night, and thank you.
I love you, too. And we'll end with Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight by James Taylor. And y'all still got a chance to go out there and party. It's not too late. It's only 9:30.
That's it.
Yeah.
Do me wrong. Do me right. Tell me lies. Save your goodbyes for the morning light, but don't let me be lonely tonight. Say goodbye and say hello. It's sure been good to see you, and it's time to go. I don't want to be lonely tonight. Go away then, you go on and do as you please.
turning my world upside down, you know. So do me wrong, but do me right, right now, baby. Go on and tell me lies, oh, hold me tight, and save your goodbye for the morning light. But don't let me be lonely tonight. I don't want to know. Please don't let me be lonely. I don't wanna be lonely tonight.